Hello, welcome back to Passive Income Pilots, everyone. Thanks so much for listening. Hey, if you're new to the show, wanted to give a quick intro to who we are, what we do. Ryan Gibson, my co-founder. My name is Tate Duryea. We're here to educate the flying community on all things real estate, finance, tax strategy, everything under the sun with an aviation focus. Ryan, how you doing, man?
I'm doing great. You know, speaking of which, if you're a new listener to the show, we're bringing on somebody who is leaving a legacy, and he was able to actually find and buy an airport, completely fix it up and renovate it through a lot of help with other people that gave back and dedicated time. And we're going to share not only his journey of how he amassed the wealth to actually do a passion project like this, but also all the ins and outs to buying an airport. How do you buy an airport? How do you find an airport? How do you finance it? How do you make money?
Renovate it.
Yeah. How do you get it? And this guy actually got his airport to break even occupancy in 18 months or break even profitability. So it's a really interesting story. This guy, I mean, how many people do you know that have flown a general aviation airplane to 53 countries?
The guy flew around the world over both poles. So unbelievable story. This is one you're going to want to listen to the whole thing. I mean, it just unbelievable story. Today we have Rob DeLaurentis. He's a successful real estate entrepreneur, investor, pilot, speaker, philanthropist, author, and founder of the DeLaurentis International Oak Harbor Airport. He's also a Gulf War veteran. He received his pilot's license in 2009 after a successful real estate career, building, renovating, and buying single-family and multifamily portfolio, and was able to buy an airport. And just an incredible story.
Yeah. And, you know, it's so relatable to Tate and I because we're real estate investors. We go out and find self-storage, multifamily, mobile home parks, things like that. And our show is all about educating our listeners on how to connect and find and get these opportunities to invest in these types of deals. And what's so interesting is that, you know, we love when aviation meets real estate investing or investing in general and sharing other people's stories and how they got there. I think it towards the end of the show, he really talks about somebody who mentored him. And I think that's a really big part about coming who you are is not just going at it alone, going at it with an outside voice or somebody helping guide you through a process. And that's the whole point of this podcast. It's we bring on great guests and great experts and specialties to help you, the pilot, better your journey throughout your career. And maybe you're listening to this and you're not a pilot, but you still enjoy aviation and you enjoy learning about the different strategies that we have. So I think this is going to go into our Hall of Fame for episodes.
Agreed.
When Tate and I end an episode and we're like excited and like pumped up about who our guest, that's how you know this is going to be a really good episode. So thank you so much for listening, everybody. I think you're really going to enjoy this one. Let's get to it.
Welcome to Passive Income Pilots, where pilots upgrade their money. This is the definitive source for personal finance and investment tactics for aviators. We interview world-renowned experts and share these lessons with the flying community. So if you're ready for practical knowledge and insights, let's roll.
Robert, so great to have you join Passive Income Pilots. The story of how we quote-unquote met, which is, by the way, we're meeting actually for the first time on the show, is, you know, Tate and I built a self-storage facility on Whidbey Island. Over about a year ago, we started the project and Tate and Turbine Capital invested in our Spartan Storage Growth Fund, which has many properties in it, one of which is on Whidbey Island. So anyway, I was going up there to check up on the construction and I flew a Cirrus up to Whidbey Island. The airport that I went to is KOKH, I think is what I had it right.
Yeah.
And it was funny, I was flying up there and I was a little nervous about going to that airport, to be completely honest, because the airport facility directory had, I think it was 30 feet wide and it was crumbling asphalt. And it was sort of like a caution, like, be careful, this runway is not very good. And so I was kind of expecting the worst, hoping for the best. And by the way, the approach that coming into that airport is beautiful. I land and I'm like, wait a minute, the runway is like twice as wide as the AFD said. And the runway is perfectly smooth, brand new asphalt. Then I pull up to the ramp area and there's like a brand new terminal building. There's awesome stuff going on. And I'm like, what the heck is going on here? There's like EV car charging at the airport, really nice signage and just a beautiful little airport. And my curiosity peaks. I went and Googled the DeLaurentis Airport and sure enough, AOPA had an article about how you had bought this airport, completely fixed it up, and breathed life into it. And I just said, oh my gosh, I've got to meet this guy. And so I did a little Googling on you. And of course, you have a really fun story writing books on for children in aviation, flying around the world, serving in the Navy. And then most interestingly, your background about being a multifamily real estate investor from California. So I thought, oh my gosh, this is like the perfect intersection of all these things. So anyway, welcome to the show. And if you don't mind, you know, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. You know, you guys are actually my peeps because like you just said, I'm a real estate guy, and San Diego real estate renovation over the span of 35 years has really funded a lot of this effort. And, you know, aviation is my passion, and where better to spend your money, your real estate money, than on aviation. So when I ended up in the Pacific Northwest after 35 years in San Diego, after doing that polar circumnavigation, you know, carrying experiments for NASA, Scripps Institution of Oceanography, biofuels, and ADS-B out, I had a little post-traumatic stress, you know, due to some of the challenges on that 8-month and 23-day trip. So I decided to sort of reinvent myself. I wanted a place where there were snow-capped mountains that went right to the ocean. I wanted road access to wherever, you know, I was going to live. And that really narrows it down quite a bit. Whidbey Island was one of those places. And I'm a former Navy guy with 4 years active, 10 reserves. And I thought, well, you know, this is going to be just like San Diego, but maybe a little bit more raw, a little bit more beautiful in some ways. And also it was an opportunity to explore a float plane life, because I always wanted to have a float plane. I never, you know, in Southern California, there's so few places you can actually fly them and land on the water. So it also put me closer to a mentor of mine. And I thought, God, what are these things called seasons? Because in San Diego, we just have the one, right? Which is sunny.
That's right.
So I decided to take a chance. And when you, any pilot, as you guys know, when you get to a new area, the first thing you do is go, well, where's the nearest airport? And I remember going out to AJ Eisenberg Airport and going, wow, this place is an incredible dump. I don't want anything to do with this. This is just too big of a project. You know, let's get out of here before we get mugged. That's a joke. There was no scary people there. At least I didn't see any. So anyway, I kept thinking about this place. I'm like, you know what? Maybe if we did this, you know, it wouldn't be so bad. Maybe if we cleaned up the potential fuel leak that everybody's talking about. You know, oh, by the way, there's a view of the water from parts of the property. And here's, you know, 32 acres of unused land. And the funny thing about it was that the property was being sold, and in my mind, it was worth two things. The value of the runway, if you ground it up into gravel, and some of the run-out buildings, because I wasn't paying for anything more than just the basic run-out structure. So I could then renovate and not feel like I had thrown money away on good stuff that I had to get rid of. And that would involve, you know, new roofs, new siding, new hangar doors, new electrical, a lot of new windows and painting, and, you know, making everything work was a huge project in itself. And then this crazy thing called insurance that they never really had on the buildings, and things like, you know, maybe these fire extinguishers need to be inspected more frequently than every 20 years, you know,
jeez.
Lighting, security cameras, you know, a website. And then I got a call from my mentor, because I had a few other projects I was considering. One was buying a P-51 Mustang that I always wanted to do.
Nice.
And another one was a global air race. And we had some interest from Red Bull and Diamond Aircraft. And at the time, Dick Rattan was going to be my partner. And then I got the call from my mentor, and she said, you know what, Robert, the airport's the one I think you need to go after. And she was very direct. You know, it's like, wow, I don't usually get it this direct from her. And she goes, it's going to be a hard project. It's going to take, she said, I don't know how long, at least 2 years, but I think this is the one we should go after. And, you know, at this stage of my life, I'm really sort of focused on legacy projects. And I thought, wow, if we do this right, and I mean like really right, this place could be around for 100 years and we'll just set my foundation up to fund it, you know, over time. But being a real estate guy like you guys, you know, I started chipping away. Like we have LEDs on the entire property. Our power bill is $132 a month. you know, we just drilled a new well. That should be good for the next 30 years. Basically setting this thing up like a rental property just to keep going, to reduce the risk, you know, the liability, setting it up in an LLC, getting new tenants, right? Because the old guys, not physically old, although some of them were, but they were sort of rigid. You know, we needed to clean out that group of pilots that wasn't supporting us and get new ones in. So it ended up being a bit of a real estate project. And, you know, by the way, I've also flown myself to 53 countries solo. So I kind of know what airports look like in different parts of the planet. Some do it well and some not so well. But yeah, it turned out to be like, I like to say it's like a grad school business project. Right? Like you got this
so cool
hulking mass with 80 cubic yards of garbage, you know, all over it, abandoned planes and cars and,
jeez,
you know, people walking on your property barefoot with shotguns coming up behind you. Just, you know, everything a landlord has to deal with, right?
Right.
To some degree. So, yeah, and we just started chipping away.
Can I ask, was this purely a passion project? Is there any profitability? How do you underwrite this? You know, you're a multifamily guy. You underwrite profitable real estate deals all the time. When you sat down, you put this into a spreadsheet. Was it ever going to be profitable, or was this just a foundation project, a passion project?
Well, I did about a year's worth of due diligence, and I talked to the airport manager at Friday Harbor. They spent $350,000 a year for 20 years before they broke even. So that's $12 million. And that was a number that I budgeted for. And I'll have you know that aside from the initial investment that I made with my money, you know, with the help of some sponsors, they gave us some discounts, they gave us, you know, free consulting, they gave us a lot of stuff, right? But at 18 months, we were turning a profit. Not a big profit, but we were carrying the airport. And the port that tried to take the airport from me illegally, I might add, to pull the property out of escrow, we stopped them. But they had no money. They had no experience with an airport. They were doing a land grab, trying to take it from me, right? And my LLC and the foundation. And we weren't going to have that. That was just wrong, you know, on so many levels. But to answer your question more directly, I funded the initial investment. And let's not underestimate the contribution of these volunteers, too, because we had a guy that did all the dirt work on the runway, which would have been, you know, in the millions, quite honestly.
Right.
And he did it
for, wow,
in my opinion, close to nothing. So you have these angels, if you want to talk about angels, that mysteriously appear at times when you really need them. And I believe that this project, like you said, Ryan, was purely a passion project for everybody who's involved. So, yeah, after the initial investment, which I made, now, you know, month to month, we make money. Not a ton, but we make money. And, you know, a lot of people were saying, oh, this is a place for a privileged, wealthy white male to have his airplanes. True, right? Because it's got to work for everybody. And I was paying $3,000 a month over at Skagit just for my twin turboprop to have a hangar there. But, you know, everybody benefits. The community benefited because they didn't have to put in the $6 million to buy it and renovate it. They don't have to pay $12 million over the next 20 years. LifeFlight has a safe place to operate out of. The pilots benefit because it's, you know, our pavement index, I just saw this yesterday through the state of Washington, is the highest in the entire state. We're at 99% out of 100. So that means we have the nicest asphalt runway in the entire state. So every pilot that flies in benefits. We have a great kids program that I'm super excited about. Yeah. And $20 doesn't cover $6 million, right? So right, these guys that are saying, you know, you can't charge us those landing fees.
Landing fee. Yeah.
Yeah. Honestly, it's to keep the people away that don't want to contribute to our community, you know?
Yeah.
Because they won't spend a nickel. And it's a really efficient way to keep the supporters coming in. You guys are, you know, great examples of that too, right?
Yeah. I mean, I emailed you, right? And I was like, hey, I don't know where I was supposed to pay. And you're like, oh, don't worry. I took a picture of your tail number. And so that was kind of cool. I didn't realize there was an automatic system that did that. And I was like, okay, great. Good. You know, who did you buy the airport from?
Well, the guy that owned it before was a guy named AJ Eisenberg. He was deceased.
Gotcha.
And his daughter was selling it. She's an attorney, but you know, it's got a really troubled past, very troubled past. I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, the guy was like chasing people around or something for landing fees or I was reading comments in ForeFlight and it didn't sound like it was a very friendly place to go.
Well, that was me chasing these guys around for their landing fees before we got the system.
That's funny. Oh, man.
Well, good for you then.
You know, phone cables are very small, right? The ones that power a regular handheld phone. We found bunches of them that big. And we were using Sawzalls to cut through these, you know, abandoned phone lines. And there was a lot of stuff going on at the airport. I'll tell you, it's phone related, right?
Wow.
So how much hangar space was there? How much is there? Did you build a bunch of new hangars? Are you leasing that? Is that what's driving the break even?
Well, we have 14 hangars and then the main hangar. About 75% of those are rented out. I'm obviously saving some money because I, you know, don't have to pay $950 a month for my float plane for a hangar or $3,000 for the twin turboprop or $800 for the carbon cub. We have charging stations, like you guys mentioned. Our biggest client, and we love them, is Life Flight. They rent one of our hangars, a couple pads for landing helicopters, some parking spaces, and we basically give them the whole sort of south corner of the southwest corner of the airport, and they come and go as they want. We also get a flowage fee from them. We sell fuel pretty close to cost at this point, at least for our avgas. We mark it up by 25 cents, which gives us the cheapest fuel, I believe, in the Pacific Northwest right now. And we do that for our pilots that are based out of the airport. We do it for people that have a tie down, which if you're looking to get your landing fees waived and cheap fuel, you get a tie down for $150 a month. But what we found too is that people don't really come from off island to base their planes at our airport. These are just people that are on the island. In fact, we don't have a single example of anybody who's more than just like across the bridge a short distance. There's nobody from Arlington or Skagit. So there hasn't been an incentive to build more hangars because, you know, we're just selling hangar space to the pilots on the island. We did look at, for a time, renting them as storage space, kind of like what you guys do. But we had so many people wanting to build a lithium battery manufacturing facility in their hangar, right? I mean, another gal that wanted to make pottery and have her kiln going, like high risk businesses. And the point was, well, you can store some stuff, but no active businesses operating out of old wood hangars that, you know, one spark and you burn them all down. So we have event space in the main hangar. We haven't really done a whole lot in there yet. Yeah.
Amazing.
That's pretty much it.
That's so cool.
And today, or as of October 30th, I noticed that airport is NOTAM closed just for the day.
Right.
What are you guys working on today?
Yeah, we're striping the runway. You know, I talked about angels. There's a guy called David Parker from the FAA. And he called me up a couple months ago with a few other people in the room. And I knew I was in for trouble because when you got a room full of FAA people calling you at once, I thought, well, that's not good. But it turned out to be great because we were about to start striping. And David said, hey, you know, you got to clear that through me. And he went to work setting up this beautiful striping plan for our international airport. And, you know, the regulations, there's books of them. Like, it's really difficult to get that right. And he got it right for us. And he's also applied for a second approach on the 2-5 side of the airport. We didn't even ask him. So I call him my bearded angel. He understands legacy, you know?
That's so cool.
And then we had been trying to find a striping contractor for over a year, found one on the island. You know, the guy would rarely call us back, came up with a really big number, you know, to the tune of $60,000-$70,000. And then one of our pilot contractors said, hey, I have the equipment to stripe this runway. I had a sign company for 20 years, and this is just a big sign. So why don't you let me do it? And he's in the process of striping it. Of course, we ran a little bit long into the, you know, the fall, and we're getting into the winter. So we have to pick and choose our days for striping. And today is a good day. We shut it down by NOTAM, and they're working on the number 2-5 now. So he already did the 7 side. So we're making great progress on it. And I don't know if you've flown over recently, but, you know, we've got these giant rectangular stripes that indicate it's a 60-foot wide runway now.
Right, right.
And all the other markings that it really feels like an international runway, because it is.
That's awesome. So yeah, I actually, the last time I was there was, I think, in August. And, you know, I actually, just to kind of underscore how important general aviation is to business. And I know you know this, Robert, but for those that, you know, that don't understand the GA world, general aviation, flying small planes into communities like this, I mean, it's such a big deal. I rent an airplane and go around the East Coast and go to little runways, little airports, little general aviation airfields to go visit my self-storage properties that are all over the East Coast most efficiently. You know, go to Louisville, Madison, Wisconsin, the Carolinas, Florida, things like that. And I can go through a lot of properties and connect with a lot of people more efficiently as a business person. When I went to your airport, I actually flew up there with an investor, and he quote said that was the best day of his life, literally.
Really?
Flying up there, landing on your beautiful airport, taxiing in, you know, jumping in a car very quickly and accessing our property and then flying right back. I mean, how magical is that?
Oh, yeah.
And one thing I wanted to ask you, Robert, a little bit before the show, you talked about how general aviation is becoming underfunded. You know, one thing that you said, the port, and that's what the chamber told me, was that the port really wanted to buy the property and they didn't have the money to really do anything with it. So it was mostly just a land grab and probably just a further deterioration of a gem in the Pacific Northwest of an airport. Can you kind of talk to us a little bit about maybe in general, like what's happening to these general aviation airports around the country, or how are you coming up with more creative ways to sort of breathe life into them? So pilots can really continue to enjoy. I mean, this is what I got into. I mean, this is what made me fall in love with aviation and want to be a pilot, was all these little airports I'd fly to as a high schooler.
Right.
You know, fly up to Northern Michigan and go skiing at Boeing and go to different parts of the country in a small plane. I mean, I remember flying into Miggs Field right before it closed, going to downtown Chicago. I mean, this is what made me want to be a pilot in the first place. And if that's starting to go away and erode, that's a big deal for our country and the future of our aviators.
You know, it's a timely question and a good question, Ryan. This morning I was talking to Representative Dent. I'm at the Washington State Aviation Convention in Leavenworth. And I said, you know, we have a pilot's bill of rights, but we don't have an airport owner's bill of rights. And wouldn't that, you know, help us to get clear on what we need to do? And he's asked me to write that.
It's amazing.
Wow.
So he asked me if I had a copy. I said, well, I thought of it yesterday. So no, I don't have a copy of what that's going to say. And I'll reach out to AOPA for their help. But my philosophy has been totally different than a lot of people. You know, there's a pot of money out there with the state that everybody's fighting for. And that battle's been going on for a while and it's messy. And I don't think anybody's going to come out of it with the money they want. I know when I started the airport, I thought, God, here's two different options. One of them is that, you know, the state, the feds, the city, the county, and the port come in and say, hey, we're really happy to have you. We appreciate, you know, what you're doing for the island. Airports are important for our financial health. And that would be a fivefold win. Or there would be not a penny from any of them, even though they were expressing interest. And do you know which side we ended up on?
Let me guess.
Not a penny.
Yeah, not a penny. So, you know, we got to do it on our own, and it turned out to be a very good thing because there was no grant assurances. There was nobody telling us you have to paint that building that color. There was nobody saying you can't do that yet. So with my background in sponsorship, you know, I had 95 sponsors on my polar circumnavigation. I thought, well, why can't this work for airports? It worked, you know, to help me raise money for the polar trip. So I started talking to them about some of the creative ideas we had, and some of them liked it. I think we're up to about 20, 25 sponsors now. Some of them are in our community, like the Sand and Gravel Company. Huge sponsor, right? We put in 12 million pounds of gravel and we got a discount off every pound. So that worked out really, really well. The other thing we've developed are fuel trailers. And our first bid to replace the 10,000 gallon tanks with above ground ones was 420,000. And then a year later, when I went back to them, the price went up to 720 with installation. And I thought, you know, if I'm making 50 cents or 25 cents a gallon on fuel, how many gallons of fuel do I have to make to cover $740,000, right? I'll never sell that. So we found a fuel trailer company, and they're called Transfueler. And then we were talking to Titan. They were giving us these upgrades. You know, you need a vapor recovery system. You need an anti-splash system. You need to be able to ground them. And then the missing part of the puzzle was a credit card processing machine. And there was basically two companies in the world. One of them was QT Pod, and they didn't want to play ball with us. They were, you know, quoting us a ridiculously high number. And then there was another company from Canada. And we just got that delivered 2 days ago. I've been out of town. But what it's going to allow to happen is that a smaller airport can have their own fuel trailers. They can buy in 1,800 gallon increments. We've set up a consortium, so we buy as a group. So it's like we're buying more fuel. We can split up the delivery charges. And then all of a sudden, you know, we can generate income. And this is part of the AOPA article that should be released next month. It's using our airport as a blueprint for the 14,000 private airports to open to the public. And if you can do that with an $80,000 fuel trailer with all the gadgets and safety equipment and turn a profit, well, you can pay off a $80,000 tank in a reasonable period of time. So there's things like that. There's the vector plane pass billing, you know, that happens automatically. There's the sponsorship. There's the charging stations. And there's just a few other things that we've done to make the airport profitable. And we're now not dependent on the state, you know, the feds, the city, county, and the port. And we can be independent, and we don't have to fight for that chunk of money that there's, you know, hundreds of people going after.
What should aviators in the state of Washington or just in the country in general be writing to their representatives and asking for as to support airports in the general aviation community?
Well, first, I would say before they even start writing, I think they need to get some skin in the game themselves. And, you know, consider that as a pilot, you need an airport. It's kind of like a tree and you're tending to the branches, but you're ignoring the trunk. The airport is definitely a critical part of your fun and your enjoyment when it comes to aviation. So I'd say first, you know, get some skin in the game. What I had told Representative Dent is that we're not trying to, or I'm not personally trying to get money from the system, because the system basically has already told me no. I'm trying to come up with ways for aviation to generate more revenue, which then fixes a lot of our problems. We're not dependent on somebody else. And he said, well, how would we do that? And I said, well, you know, I need to look into this because I just thought about this yesterday for the first time, but maybe just getting out of our way and letting us do what business can do for aviation. One example of that is when I was going for a runway permit at my airport, I went to the planning department and they said, okay, we've got to put you on the back of the list because you're a private individual. And I said, but the airport is for public use and we're supporting organizations that help our community. You need to treat us, you know, fast track us, treat us like a commercial enterprise that you would normally give priority to. And it took the involvement of our some of our county administrators to push that through more quickly. But I think that would be critical, right? Moving these projects through, because time is money. We know that as real estate people, right? Yeah, and I haven't composed a lot of it, but I do know that we need better representation as private airport owners since we're doing it on our own.
Robert, you said you've flown into 53 countries with general aviation, right? And so I really want to echo what Ryan said about how special the United States is with all of these GA airports. It's unbelievable. We're so lucky in this country, and we need to not let go of this. Do you want to talk at all about your experiences in other countries? What countries do it well? What countries don't? And what can we learn from that?
Okay. Yeah, Europe, great, right? They're probably the next best place, I think, to fly. I remember I had been charged $3,000 landing and other fees to go into Anadyr, Siberia. And I wasn't aware that that was coming, right? So that was my worst experience. And then I thought, well, I'm smarter now. I'm going to check at these different airports and see what they're going to charge me in advance. You know, try and get something in writing, which was hard to do. And I remember I was going to go land in Malaysia. And I called up and I said, hey, what are the fees? And they said, well, it depends on who's working. So
wow,
these guys can charge whatever they wanted, you know? And I finally nailed them down, and I think it was like $1,000 for a Malibu. And I'm like, no, I'm not going to go there, right? Wow. So I'd say Europe is a super fun place to go. You know, there a lot of the places speak English. There is a little bit of influence of AOPA and some clubs, but, you know, vastly underdeveloped compared to the United States. And that probably goes back to World War II, which, you know, is when a lot of this stuff got set up after the war, the surplus airplanes. And yeah, and, you know, but to argue the other side, GA pilots are no easy group to deal with. You know, they come in, they want stuff. And they're difficult. So, and then when you compare that to, well, I can fuel, like the other day we fueled a Chinook helicopter with the Army and they took 300 gallons. You know, some of the GA guys are coming in asking for 10.
Right, right.
And if you're making 25 cents like we are to cover our costs, we basically make no money on that, right? We're providing the fuel as sort of a incentive to make our pilots happy and, you know, it's convenient, that sort of thing. So I understand both sides of it, right? But the U.S. is established and, yeah, a total blessing.
Yeah, you mentioned Life Flight takes up a significant amount of your airport. And just to make sure people who are listening who don't know what that is, what is Life Flight and what does that contract look like? And is that like a significant portion of your revenue?
Yeah, it's our biggest customer, right? They're not for profit like we are, but they, you know, they run it efficiently like a business. And easiest guys to deal with, guys and gals, very professional. We charge them a flowage fee because they like to use their own tank. Or sometimes they'll fly a PC-12 in and they'll use our Jet A tank as well.
And they're transporting patients, organs,
yes,
last minute things. Yeah.
Yeah. So let's say you're in a car accident on the island and, you know, time is of the essence. You have basically two options. You can take an ambulance, and in about 2 hours and 30 minutes, you'll ride on the ferry. You'll get bumped around pretty good, right? You'll drive a long distance. Or you can hop in a Life Flight helicopter and be there in 15, 20 minutes, you know, right at the hospital. And I actually am a member of their, I think I have a lifetime subscription with them. So they cover you anywhere, you know, in their region, which is the Pacific Northwest, I believe. But it's the best deal.
Yeah, and if they didn't go to your well-run airport, where would they go? Or how would that change their perspective or their timing on?
Well, they would be doing maintenance on another island. And it turns out that Coopville is one of their busiest hospitals. So Coopville basically sort of like, I think the word is triages people, gets them ready to go over to SeaTac. So they have during COVID, I think that was their busiest hospital. So having their maintenance facility very close to the hospital is a huge advantage to them. They don't have to fly to a lot of different places to get stuff done.
It's amazing.
I think their next biggest place might be over at Renton. They just opened up a facility there as well. So yeah, wonderful organization. We love them. When we have an event, we always ask them to send a helicopter over to do a flyover. And I remember one, they showed up and it was an all-female crew. And, you know, the kids were just going crazy.
Yeah.
You know, hopping in the helicopter, talking to the pilots. And
that's so cool.
I guess you would call them nurses. Yeah. Great organization.
You mentioned you had, I think, 95 sponsors on your biofuel trip. And you said, I have that skill and that experience of getting sponsors to back what your passion projects are, what you're doing. And you said that kind of played favorably into doing this airport, like getting people who are your angels to help you with your excavation, maybe your striping and painting, things like that. What advice would you give to somebody if they're thinking, man, I want to buy an airport, but I don't know the first thing about asking for help or trying to find those angels? What advice would you have to those people?
Yeah, that's a long answer to that because I could probably write a book on the subject, but let me just say a few things. First of all, it's not about what you want. It's about what you can do to help them. And let's take, for example, could be like a battery manufacturer, Concord Batteries, right? If we have planes that we're operating, like for the kids program or something like that, you can then get in-kind sponsorship. And then what we do is we put them on what we call the Wall of Fame. And you guys took a picture, I believe, in front of that. So you pull into the airport, you see all the sponsor logos. You would see their logo on our website, on our social media posts, there might be a reference to it. And then sometimes if it's related to our kids playing sugar, we would have a logo. They're not on that, but, you know, Lightspeed Headsets is one of our big sponsors. So they definitely get some great exposure as well.
That's great.
That's amazing. Yeah.
Robert, I'd love to hear about this trip around the world. You said you spent 8 months, you know, pulling NOAA and atmospheric equipment around the world. I mean, can you tell us about that trip? What was the genesis and like, how'd you end up on it? And give us some highlights.
Yeah, there's a movie that we just released December 3rd of last year. It's on Amazon Prime, Google TV, and Apple TV called Peace Pilot. And in an hour and 52 minutes, it'll teach you a lot about that, as well as a book called Peace Pilot to the Ends of the Earth and Beyond, and an audiobook by the same title. But, you know, I had successfully completed the equatorial circumnavigation in 2015 in a plane called the Spirit of San Diego. And I thought it was going to be a one and done for most people that circumnavigate it is. And then I started thinking, well, what would be the next level? You know, what would be more difficult, more rewarding, more challenging, right? And I started thinking, well, there's so few people that have flown the poles. Nobody in a twin turboprop has ever done it. And, you know, I'm a little bit of a citizen scientist, and that I'm very curious about, you know, the science that's out there that aviation can support. And a lot of times you have guys that are just flying around for the fun, but aviation has a much bigger purpose, right? It can further science. Like, for example, our plastic particle experiment determined that there was more plastics in the atmosphere over the poles than over the equator where all the population is. So that's like discovering plastic islands in the air. And then, you know, we're showcasing some of the sponsors' equipment. You know, ADS-B Out was used for the first time over the poles on my trip. So it's not just, you know, we have a system that we're flying, but it's making history too. So, you know, we wanted it to have a lot of layers to it. We wanted it to be inspiring. We wanted to showcase the aviation technology. We wanted to further science. And, you know, one person said, oh, that's a sponsor funded vacation. Well, when you're in Dakar, Senegal, and your fuel tank bursts and throws Jet A on your face, your groin, your arms, your chest, and you have chemical burns, you know, and then you have to get in that plane that has 11 gallons of jet fuel sloshing around beneath the floorboards, and your eyes are watering, and you can taste jet fuel when you swallow. It's not necessarily a fun trip, right? But you realize that your mission just became bigger than you. It became more important than you. So, you know, there's a tremendous amount of learning, not just for the people that are following this, but, you know, on a spiritual level for me, I was like, well, why am I being like cosmically tortured for 8 months and 23 days? And it took me a year to figure it out. And the reason, or at least one of the reasons, was that all living things suffer, right? You know, the birds that are out there in the world that break a leg or a wing or a plant that gets, you know, some bug on it. That's the one commonality we all have. And the trip became about connecting everybody on the planet from the North Pole to the South Pole and everybody in between.
That's incredible.
I think your next book idea should be, by the way, it sounds like you've written a lot of children's books, and we'll get into that in a second as well, but your next book should be on how to buy and operate an airport. Maybe you already wrote about it. I don't know.
You know, I haven't done that. My mentor has encouraged me to do that. This article in AOPA, you know, which is the blueprint to convert the private airports to public, is a little bit of that. I don't know how big an audience it would have, but I'm certainly willing to talk about it as much as people will listen. It's, you know, for you guys as pilots, I got to tell you, it was another avenue of aviation that I wanted to experience, because I always felt like I was taking these huge risks in the air, you know, over the South Pole at minus 60 Celsius, you know, the risk of fuel gelling and loss of navigation, all that. And I thought, maybe I'll try something that's a little less dangerous, right? And I thought I'll do something ground-based. And it was by far one of the most frustrating projects I've ever done, but also the most rewarding, especially now that it's done, right? Because it's easy to see the vision. It's easy to enjoy it. It's got good energy. It's doing something positive. So I would just encourage anybody who's in aviation to go, you know, there's all these other pieces of aviation besides flying. Like, look at you guys, you're doing a podcast on aviation, right? So yeah, it's been pretty rewarding. And, you know, on my days off, I'm usually at the airport because I have my RC planes there. I have my side-by-side. You know, there's usually somebody walking around who has questions or wants to talk or just decent people.
That's the magic of GA airports.
Yeah, it's so much fun. So anybody who's listening to this, who's like thinking, you know, I know that there's airline pilot forums about general aviation and getting back to flying and pilots going out and buying airplanes now and getting back into it. And they might be thinking, geez, what would be even my first step to buy an airport? Which ones would I even go to, or where would I even go to see which ones are for sale? Or how would you even go about like finding one like this? I mean, this like passion project, where would they start?
I had no intention of buying an airport, you know, when I came to the island. In my case, it was sort of tossed in my lap, right? I went to the closest airport to this new place I moved, and it turns out it was for sale. I know on social media, I've seen some, you know, airports listed. I think if you got online, you could probably find them. I think key, though, is it's got to make sense for your lifestyle, too. Like, this airport is 30 minutes from where I live. You know, it's on the island that I love. Got extremely lucky in that case. So I would start by looking as close to your, you know, house or your home as you can.
Yeah. I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about your past multifamily investing journey. Can you kind of tell us about, you know, I mean, obviously you've done really well for yourself, put yourself in a position to buy an airport and do all these passion projects. Can you kind of give us a little background on your real estate and kind of how you got to this point in your career?
Well, it's funny a question because the guy came to the airport the other day and he asked me, which bank did I rob? And the answer was none. Like when all my friends were going to Vegas on the weekend, having a fun time, I was underneath a rental property, you know, cutting out sewage lines and, you know, brazing copper pipes, you know, in a pool of like sewage. So it wasn't a glorious time, you know, building my portfolio. But I just was always a real estate guy. I saw my dad buying rental properties when I was a kid, and he didn't have the best experience. I remember driving up to one of them, and there was an engine block in the front yard, you know, and the windows were sort of busted out. But I slowly learned that there was a better way to do that. You know, I went to business school. I was at Arthur Anderson right out of college. So I got a little bit of, not right out of college, after the Navy, I went back. I got a little bit of training there. And this concept of being able to live in a place, rent parts of it out to other people and make money, I thought was pretty exciting.
Absolutely.
And I started buying properties. You know, I was using some credit card advances to come up with the cash. And then I would quickly renovate the properties, pay them off. And I was in Southern California, which, you know, the price of real estate was rising. I had a property that was actually in a gay area, and it just skyrocketed in value. So I would then pick the other areas, you know, where that community was moving and start buying properties there, like in an expanding circle.
Yeah.
And I'd go back into the Navy. I'd get a 6-month set of orders. And the banks really liked naval officers because we paid our loans on time. We didn't give them a lot of hassle. And yeah, that was what got me started, was buying real estate in San Diego. And again, another really lucky place to start out, right? Because once you own enough in San Diego, you can pretty much go anywhere in the world and afford real estate somewhere else.
What was the strategy? So you said you house hacked, essentially, lived in the house, rented out the other rooms, renovated. When you were done with that, did you move to the next place and keep that original one as a rental property and just sort of leapfrog from single family home to single family home?
You know, I started with single family homes. And then the sort of test that I would use is after I renovated a property, it had to make at least $500 a month to sort of compensate me for all the aggravation and the, you know, small claims lawsuits and the frustration with contractors. You guys know that.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that doesn't happen. I thought this is just all up and to the right.
You know, so then I would rent one out and then I was making a little bit more money. And it was at a time when San Diego, when the real estate prices were very low and everybody was saying, hey, don't do it. You're crazy. My dad told me I was taking, you know, I was over leveraged. I was taking too many risks. And I said, well, Dad, I don't have anything really. You know, I have a car And if I lose everything, I can just start over. I'm young. And he didn't like that theory. He was a Fortune 500 CFO, Ivy League guy, and that just seemed too radically entrepreneurial to him. But it worked out for me, and I was lucky because I didn't have any major failures early on, which can sort of sour the waters, right?
Totally.
So I would just keep buying, and then started to buy bigger and bigger buildings. And then I got to the point where I was buying a couple at a time, especially around the end of the year when everybody else was kind of desperate to get rid of their properties, you know, for tax reasons. Yeah, and then I had enough where I didn't have to go back into the Navy and work, you know, for 6 months at a time. I could live off the cash flow. And I wasn't living a glorious, you know, life during those years. I had a joke that I liked Top Ramen, just not every day.
That's wisdom right there for all the airline pilots listening out there.
You know, I might eat it once or twice a day, and I'd get it at the commissary for 16 cents a package. I remember that. I was like, okay, 32 cents, that's a meal. And yeah, I was going without while my friends were spending lots of money having a really good time. I missed out on a little bit of life early on, quite honestly, because I was so focused on the business and growing it. But now, you know, I retired for the first time at 37. And it was just, you know, I had just one house, but I had enough cash flow coming in. I didn't need to work. And I thought, oh, I'm too young and I could have a bigger portfolio. So I went back to work. And at 43, I finally checked out, you know, permanently from that and started focusing on the foundation. Yeah, so it was a struggle early on, but I'm really happy that I did it early.
When did you get really into the general aviation stuff? Was that during the portfolio building phase, or was that after 43 when you fully checked out?
Yeah, pretty much 43 was the magic number. And I never had the time and money together. I might have one, but not the other. So finally, I could reliably take lessons and make time for the lessons and not let a long, you know, period go between, you know, one lesson and the next.
Where'd you learn to fly?
Montgomery Field.
I instructed there for years. I love that airport. Yeah,
it's pretty cool. I still have a hangar there. I rent it out right now, but what is it, Plus One Flyers? Did
Plus
you work
One
for them?
Yeah, I did. I did. I was an independent instructor at Plus One for years. Even when I was flying the Metroliner out of Coronado, I was instructing on the weekends up at Montgomery. I love that airport.
Yeah, the Metroliner is one I considered when I was looking for a plane to do the polar circumnavigation.
Well, that's crazy.
Yeah,
they take a Metroliner with no autopilot. And
the disadvantages I found is they didn't fly high enough and they were older. They did have the Garrett engines, which were pretty nice. Did you have a water injection in yours?
We did. Yeah, we didn't use it much, but we did have the Owie. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that's a pretty cool plane. I wouldn't mind having one of those. Yeah, but it just turned out the turbine commander had a few more, you know, qualities to it that were really good. But that was the first plane that was suggested to me.
That's cool.
Well, Robert, you've been really generous with your time. I have a lightning round. Favorite general aviation airport to fly to in the Pacific Northwest, other than yours?
Oh, okay. Well, that's no fun. I was going to say mine.
Hey, by the way, if you fly to Robert's airport, it's on Whidbey Island near Oak Harbor. You can fly there. You can get a car. They have a beautiful facilities there for their pilots. And if you walk kind of across the street, there's a drive-in movie theater and a go-kart track for the kids. So that's kind of fun.
Yeah, right now there's a pumpkin patch as well. Or if you walk out of the airport and go to the left, you can go down to the water. It's just a short walk and it's really beautiful down there as well.
So if you're looking for a great destination, it is perfect. So for business and for fun. All right, best airport outside of your airport in the PNW. Where should I go?
I'll give you two. I like Orcas Island. I think that's pretty cool. You can walk to some really fun stuff. And then there's a place called Point Roberts as well. It's a grass strip just south of the Canadian border. And they have a little cute town. You can walk there, get some lunch. It's out of the way. I kind of like that place too.
That's awesome. Favorite airplane? General aviation airplane.
Turbine Commander 900 with mods to get it as far as the South Pole and 19-hour legs. I'll never pick a one that's more important to me. And it's actually at the airport, too. You can see that now.
Sweet.
Craziest story from an airport on that 8-month tour?
I'd have to say Dakar, Senegal, when I was refueling. It's in the midst of a sandstorm. I was getting ready to fly to the island of San Tome, which is right off the coast of Africa. I had this sort of knot in my stomach. Something was very wrong. Pulled up. There was a great guy from the FBO, nice uniform, good smile, good communicator. I thought, I'm going to fuel tonight. And I'm fueling my number one ferry tank, which was like a header tank. I hear this cracking sound, and then there's an explosion of fuel that sprays into my eyes, my chest, my arms, my legs, and I'm falling out of the plane thinking, okay, it's over. This plane's going to catch on fire. It's going to blow up. You know, at least I made the South Pole already earlier in the trip. And then I hit the ground, and I was like, I'm still alive. Like, how is that possible? I yelled for water. And then the fuel was spraying out of the plane. I think it sprayed over 100 gallons. And I jumped right back in with my survival knife, cut the drain line on the tank, and grabbed some plastic to try and divert the fuel out of the plane. But that would change, you know, the trajectory of that trip in terms of, you know, dealing with the fuel-soaked interior of a plane flying it at 30-plus thousand feet for the rest of the trip.
That's crazy. But getting to number four, favorite aviation movie other than The Peace Pilot on Amazon?
That's hard. You know, I'm a Tom Cruise fan. I'm sorry. I know that's pretty yeah. general.
Oh, I love that movie.
Oh, yeah. Who doesn't?
I've watched it too many times.
Too many times. I think I've watched the ending of Maverick with my son no less than 55 times in the last 12 months. Such a great ending.
Oh, you know what's funny? It's funny, when I was flying over the South Pole, there was a guy there that was manning the comm station, and I asked permission to fly over, and he said, negative, Ghost Rider. The last Tom Cruise movie was supposed to come out, and I'm like, is he quoting like from the Tom Cruise movie and we're over the South Pole here? Like, neither one of us is going to see this thing for months. And it was just like that common bond between people that love movies, right? Like,
oh,
quoting
yeah.
them and
that's too cool.
Laughing about them.
I want to hear about this mentor. Who is she, and why is she your mentor? And tell me about how you guys came to connect.
Yeah, one of my favorite people in the world. Her name's Susan Gilbert. She's the vice president of my foundation. And, you know, if you go back in history, the kings had oracles, right? And they relied on these people to give them advice, to guide them. And Susan, being one of the more spiritual people that I know on this planet, I talk to her every morning. And if you think about business school, right, you go, we all study those Harvard case studies, and then you try and be smarter than the next guy and come up with a better solution, but you're all competing like in the same fishbowl. But if you can get some other information from another source, that puts you sort of above and beyond everybody else. And the whole spiritual component of what we do at the De Laurentiis Foundation, which includes Susan's guidance, is critical, and it sets us apart consistently over everybody else who's competing with us. So like I said earlier, you know, Susan called me up one morning because I was trying to decide between these three projects. And as directly as we're speaking, she said, I believe the airport's your next project. And, you know, when there's those really difficult decisions, I call her. So I was walking out to the Citizen of the World when I was getting ready to leave from Ushuaia, Argentina, and my phone rang. It was the guy who did the ferry tanks, and he said, hey, the FAA has some questions. You know, you could lose your license over this. And I texted Susan like, oh my God, what do I do? And she said, now you need to focus on safety and making this trip happen, and we'll deal with any issues that pop up afterwards. And then all of a sudden, you know, my mind was going nuts, and then I'm back on focusing on the safety of the trip. And everything worked out perfectly, you know, with the FAA, but it was just a moment when you lose your clarity and you need some extra help or guidance. And she is the one person in the world that does that for me and for the foundation. And she's a pilot. She's the person who got me into flying. She got me into spirituality, and she and I were in small business together. It was my first venture into small business. In fact, she got two filing cabinets and put a door on top of it. That was my first desk. So instrumental to my efforts, and I'm sure the other people that she helps as well.
That's incredible.
Amazing.
Well, Robert, we could go on for another hour here. And this is so fascinating. I'm fascinated to learn more about you. I'm sure our listeners are as well. How do people, you know, follow you, connect with you, get your book, watch the movie, look up your foundation? How do we find out more about you and follow you?
Sure. There's a landing page called Peace Pilot the Movie, and that'll get you, you know, to the movie. It has some links. The airport is DeLaurentisAirport.com. And if you want to read for 100 hours and you want to see all the online stuff, the interviews, the news interviews, the articles, you can just go to Flying Through Life, and the through is THRU. You could also go to poletopoleflight.com and find all this stuff too. It's pretty easy to locate.
We'll link to all that in the show notes.
Well, Robert, we are so grateful for you to come on. When we can find the intersection of investing and just doing something for legacy at the cross intersection of aviation, we're just always overjoyed to bring on an interesting guest like yourself. So thank you so much for coming on and talking to us about your life experience. It's been great.
Yeah, and I appreciate you guys because we're, like I said, you're my peeps. And, you know, real estate is a profitable venture if you do it right. And I would say, you know, the next level beyond that is what are you going to do to create your legacy and what impact can you have on the world? And in our cases, it happens to be aviation. So using real estate to fuel some of those ventures is a fantastic way, I think, to create a legacy.
I couldn't agree more. Thank you so much. And thanks for tuning in. And we'll catch you guys on the next episode.